Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, we have a special issue on Fresh Voices, new writers, and we have interviews with two of them. The short story writer, Jamie Quatro.
For me, a lot of what I write starts with music, starts with a cadence or a pulse or a sound, and the words come up through that. Each story and each poem, each work has its own music. And I think it's the artist's responsibility to listen for that music and transpose it into words.
And novelist Carlene Bauer.
You know, I wanted to fill in the gaps that the historical record left. You know, did she really have a crush on him? Like, what was the nature of her disappointment? What would she have said to him if she could have said something? And so that's where I think, I hope they start to become people in their own right.
Leslie Kaufman has notes from the field. And Greg Coles has bestseller news.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
One of the most remarkable fresh voices we showcase this week, sounds like a mixed metaphor, is Jamie Quatro, who is a collection of short stories called I Want to Show You More. It's reviewed by J. Robert Lennon. Reviewed isn't even the verb for this. It's a kind of, what shall we call it, a verbal orgasm. But here's some of what he says. He says that Quatro is a truly excellent writer who pursues her obsessions, allows them to dictate what form her work will take. A brutally thoughtful piece of work, a writer of great originality and artistic maturity, thrilling and disarmingly honest. I'm delighted that Jamie's here to talk about her work. Welcome.
Thank you.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
Okay, let's get to one of the really big themes you write about, which is adultery. And we have a literate audience, and they know that two of probably the five greatest novels ever written, Madame Bovary and Anna Karenina, are about adulterous women. Why is this so rich and full of topics still?
So interesting that you point out Madame Bovary, because Madame Bovary was the book I was reading when I wrote Decomposition, the corpse story. There was a scene where her corpse is laid out and Flaubert describes the black fluid that comes out of her mouth, and that was sort of the seminal moment for that story.
Why?
I had never thought much about human decomposition, and when I read that in Flaubert, you know, Flaubert had that rigorous attention to detail that most mid-19th century novelists did not have. They would gloss right over that, you know, go right past the funeral. And I kind of decided to research human decomposition, and as I was doing that, I was thinking about the stages of grief, and I thought, well, a grief that can't be named, perhaps, would be grief over an infidelity. And so I put the two things together, and the corpse, I guess, became a stand-in for that.
And Jamie, another major critic, some would say the best writer in English now, James Wood, who also admires your work very much and wrote about it in The New Yorker, mentions that, and it's true in a number of the stories, the adultery doesn't necessarily really happen.
Yes.
Or it's happened in the past, and it becomes sort of entwined with the narrator's or the protagonist's consciousness in sometimes very short stories. How do you decide that 3 pages is enough to get the thing said?
I think each story comes to you with its own demands. Those very short pieces actually started out as poems. And as I read through the poems, I realized they were closer to sentences. And so I expanded those into what are now flash pieces. So I think that the music of a piece as it's coming, it comes in different ways, depending on character and depending on what I'm writing about.
And there's also often a religious component.
Yes.
I mean, this is, you know, the Ten Commandments tell us not to do this. And so what is your relationship to your characters as you're imagining this brief history they've had or longed for or regret? Mm-hmm. How do you get into that particular character's mind?
Well, in the context of religion, I think that one of my obsessions is this notion that sexuality and spirituality are often divided or thought of as kind of opposite ends of the spectrum, but that in scriptural text, they're often very closely aligned. You have language like the bride and the bridegroom and the consummation and, you know, unless you consume me, you have no part in me. I was interested in looking, well, what are the intersections between sexuality and spirituality, instead of what are the divisions and what are the thou shalt nots?
What about the thou shalt nots? How important is it for a fiction writer to follow lines of thought or imagination that take you places that really we're not supposed to go?
It is of the utmost importance that fiction writers do that. What is the point of fiction if not to take us places that we don't normally go in our real lives? I feel like the imagination is tremendous power, and it's the beauty of fiction is that we can escape our lives and go to places. So, yes, I think it's imperative that we pursue every avenue, and if it works, it works, and it becomes a story, and if it doesn't work, you throw it out and start over.
Jamie, one of the bigger things going on in the culture that's been discussed a fair amount, really for a number of years now, this newspaper's written some stories, articles on it, we've done it here at the Book Review, is what seems to be the resurgence of the short story as a form. What's the attraction? Apart from the fact that it may be a little easier to write for the fiction writer just because you don't have as many pages. But also it has to be more perfected. You have to get everything right. Mm-hmm. What is the attraction for you as an artist to work in this often, in your case, very terse short form?
Well, first I have to disagree with you about the short story being easier to write than the novel. I'll quote Faulkner, who said that everyone tries poetry and fails, and then they try the short story, which is also very difficult, fails, and then they go to the novel. So
that's what happened to John Updike, you know.
Yes, exactly.
Who also thought, by the way, that you couldn't really be taken seriously as a writer. Now, that was the culture he came out of, a hugely ambitious novelist trying to cram all of America into single words.
Right.
But what about this kind of increasing stature and status? George Saunders is the example. People point to Laurie Moore, Amy Hempel, someone that you acknowledge.
My thesis advisor.
So tell us about your relationship with her.
With Amy Hempel? I studied with her at Bennington. Which in their low residency MFA program. My last term, she was my thesis director, which means you sort of have your stories finished and near finished, and then she helps me get them polished and ready to be accepted as a thesis.
And how much of it is about the voice, hearing the way people speak, hearing the rhythms of the way normal people like ourselves, you know, become transcendent in the things we imagine or yearn for?
Right. I think a keenly musical sensibility underlies, or should underlie, everything that makes it into print. For me, a lot of what I write starts with music, starts with a cadence or a pulse or a sound, and the words come up through that, or the voice comes up through that. Each story and each poem, each work has its own music. And I think it's the artist's responsibility to listen for that music and transpose it into words.
Another really excellent writer of our time, Jennifer Egan, once told me that she will revise portions of her work as many as 79 or 80 times.
Oh, how much?
Now, I haven't heard of anybody who does that, at least that volume. But are you a rewriter and redrafter and tell it from different points of view, turn the piece around? Now, how much goes into each story?
I draft longhand, and I try to allow myself no revision at that point. So just mess, just flinging paint onto a canvas.
So when you say no revision, beginning to end, you're just going to get there somehow the first time through.
Somehow, whether it's in fragments, however I can get there, to at least see what my arc is, to at least see, okay, where am I going with this? And then I'll try to get everything together and start putting it into the computer. And that's where I really start editing myself at the sentence level. From there, I'll take it through. I've never done 79 to 80 revisions. I can say that right now. But anywhere up to 20, 25, you know, overhauls, revisions. Usually what it looks like for me is like arranging pieces of the puzzle, because I'll often write in short sections with white space between. And so taking those and thinking, well, maybe the ending belongs at the beginning. Maybe the beginning needs to come at the end. And just looking at all those possibilities. But eventually, the pieces morph into place. And then it goes to my trusted readers, people I've studied with or people I've met along the way at places like Yaddo and McDowell Colony and Suwannee. Just people that we have a natural rapport, and we say, hey, you want to trade work? And it's really wonderful to have a few of those relationships. And so then after they get it, then it, you know, then my agent and my editor and everybody comes into it, and eventually it takes its shape. And usually I don't let it go until I'm getting page proofs with like giant red notes, no more revisions. You can make typo corrections, but no substantive changes.
Well, and you then know, W.H. Auden once said that writers don't want praise. They want flattery. And they don't really want criticism. They want people to tell you that what you're doing is great. Do you really look for criticism? Somebody to say, this doesn't work, or I don't buy this, or
yes.
Or set that one aside and start all over again?
So there's a story in the book called Sinkhole. And at one point, I had the character in that story with a gun duct taped to his torso. And he was running with this gun because he was going to put himself out of his misery if this sinkhole in his chest got too large. I sent it to all my friends. Everybody was fine. I sent it to my agent, and she said, lose the gun. Just get rid of it. It doesn't work. It feels like a foreign object in this story. And she was absolutely right. And I covet that kind of criticism and that kind of feedback. I would never say I'm in this for flattery or to be told that I'm doing everything right. I mean, I don't think a serious writer would really want that.
So what's next for you?
I'd like to keep writing short stories. It's what I'm passionate about. You mentioned earlier the resurgence of interest in the short story, and there's a lot of ideas floating around about, well, perhaps it's this shortened attention span because of the internet, and I disagree. I think that in our fractured lives, we're longing for an emotional connection that's deep and goes deep quickly, and that the short story can deliver that and can deliver that over and over and over again within a single volume. So I hope to continue writing stories. I'd also like to write literary criticism. I'm not going to say the N-word yet, but maybe someday. Maybe I'll be like Updike.
Well, write some criticism for us.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Jamie.
Thank you.
That's Jamie Quattro, whose new book, I Want to Show You More, is featured in our Fresh Voices issue.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is Argo, How the CIA and Hollywood Pulled Off the Most Audacious Rescue in History by Antonio Mendez and Matt Baglio. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
Leslie Kaufman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Leslie.
Hello, Sam.
I'm going to begin by telling you a little anecdote. Some years ago, when our children's books editor, preceding Pamela Paul, who of course is great, was the also great Julie Just. And she used to say the toughest books to find for review and the ones that were most difficult for publishers to get to readers were what we call the middle grade books. They're not YA, young adult. They're not picture books. They're somewhere in between. But you've got a story, kind of a great story, about a middle grade reader author who's become a huge success.
Yes, you don't hear her name the way you hear the names of some other huge successes like Suzanne Collins, but she's out there and she's selling millions and millions of books. It's Rachel Renee Russell, and she is the author of The Dork Diaries. And if you were a girl under the age of 12, you would have read all of these.
How many are there?
She's about to publish her sixth in June.
The Dork Diaries. You know what? The title's already great. So tell us a little more about the author and her. I assume there's a female character, and tell us about her.
So the author, Rachel Renee Russell, is a divorced bankruptcy attorney, the last person you'd expect to be channeling a middle schooler. But she has a real rapport with 12-year-old girls and under, because Nikki is pretty and talented, but thinks she is.
So this is the character is Nikki?
The character is Nikki Maxwell. She is pretty and popular, but is constantly worried about fitting in, a universal middle school concern. She's done these in a diary format, so it's like you've opened up Nikki's diary and heard her complaining, and she does it with lots of exclamation points and lots of illustrations, which are sort of charming and funny. She has a real sense of humor about it, and it's very attractive.
Are they the author's own illustrations? Or
well, what's very interesting, the first book she illustrated herself. The second books and future books have been illustrated by her own daughter, the real Nikki.
Oh, it's so interesting. Okay. Now tell us, there's another fascinating aspect to this too that has to do with what shall we say, ethnicity and diversity. The surprising matchup here.
That's right. So if you follow children's books, you'll know that there's a long-running concern that there aren't enough books by minorities about minority communities that make it into the top sellers. She is a fabulously top-selling author. She is an African-American woman, but what is very interesting is she chose to make her character, Nikki Maxwell, the author of The Dork Diaries, white. She's very articulate on why she decided to do this. One, she said she just feels that African-Americans shouldn't be forced to write only African-American characters.
Which is something many African-American writers, going all the way back to James Baldwin and Ralph Ellison, said.
Right. And she also said something which is another fear out there, and I don't know whether it's true or not, but it's certainly a fear out there, that if you write a African-American story, that they will put you on a special shelf, that you won't be in with everyone else and that you can't be mainstream. And she wanted all along to be mainstream. As she said to me, Nikki comes in every hue. She's that middle grader with all those middle grader concerns. And that's, I wanted her to be available for everybody.
Now, are there African-American characters, other characters who show up in
the
diary?
Well, her best friends, one's Latino and one is African-American. But the stick drawings, which are in black and white, the illustrations and go through, really don't reveal anyone ethnicity, and it sort of never comes up in the context of the book. So you could, I think, project whatever you wanted onto these girls.
Well, you're a mom, I'm a dad. Kids today, as they're growing up, really are not so conscious of these differences as maybe an older generation was.
I think that's entirely possible. Though I do think it's interesting that if it is impossible, she chose to make her character white. There is, at very least, still a fear out there, and I've had other authors mentioned this to me, a fear out there that if they made up minorities about something that was specifically minority, it would not be put on the shelf and sell as well.
Okay, now you're talking in a quite literal way about the shelf in bookstores. Are they actually ghettoized for young readers?
Well, first of all, there are young readers' shelves. You know that, and I know that.
Yes.
There are certainly young readers' sections. And the question is whether publishers would be as interested in it. We recently did a story about First Book, which is a group that brings books to low-income groups, and they have said that there are not enough stories, they feel, and there have been all sorts of studies on this, with protagonists who are African-American, who are homosexual, who are Latino, who are any number of things. And they believe that there is a market out there for protagonists who face problems specific to those groups of people.
But at the same time, Leslie, as an author or publisher, yes, you want to reach that readership, but you don't want your book, well, let's say it's segregated from others. Is that right?
Right, and that was clearly her decision. This was, and her book is a very universal book. It's really not about ethnicity at all. Nikki goes to Westchester Country Day School. She faces middle-class girl problems that any sort of middle-class American child might face. She worries about being popular. She worries about not being invited to parties. She gets tripped in the cafeteria.
So there are mean girls.
There are mean girls she has to face down. It's always the problem of fitting in.
Does she touch on, in my experience, what really seems to be the most fraught and anxiety-inducing problem at all, which is shopping?
She is fashion challenged. This is a big problem with her. She is very fashion challenged, whereas the mean girls have great clothes. But she's a winner. She's artistic. She has really good friends. In the end, you know that Nikki deserves our love.
Thanks so much, Leslie.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Barl Segal. One of the fresh voices in our issue is the young writer Carlene Bauer. Her new book is Frances and Bernard, and it's a very unusual novel in letters between two writers based on Robert Lowell and Flannery O'Connor. It was reviewed by Christopher Benfey, who calls it a story of conversion, shattered love, and the loss of faith, recalling 20th century masters like Graham Greene and Walker Percy. Welcome, Carlene.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start talking a little bit about the actual inspirations for your two characters. It's hard not to think of two writers or individuals that were as different as Lowell and O'Connor. You know, O'Connor so aloof and sickly. Actually, Lowell was pretty sickly too, but, you know, expansive. And yet they were friends. Can you tell us a little bit about what drew them together?
Well, I know that they met at Yaddo in about 58 or so.
That was the first time that either of them had met. Lowell had converted to Catholicism earlier, but had sort of floated away from it. But meeting Flannery O'Connor, I think, this is what I remember from reading Paul Ely's book, The Life You Saved, Maybe Your Own, where I found out that they were friends. Uh-huh. I think meeting her, a devout Catholic, sort of brought him back into the fold. I think that's maybe how even Lowell characterizes it. And they became friends there. And during Lowell's first manic episode, which was shortly after their meeting, he, in some of his ravings, declared O'Connor a saint. Mm. And this, understandably, as we would now say, freaked her out. But they remain friends. There's also some suggestion in Ely's book, he mentions that O'Connor might have had a crush on him. And I feel I've read elsewhere that O'Connor might have felt a little bit of the same. But it was after Lowell had this first manic episode, he questioned his faith and then sort of let it drop.
Okay.
And I think that cooling off of faith disappointed O'Connor. And I don't think that she ever mentioned this to him. She mentioned this to other people in her letters, but I don't believe that she ever said to him, this is a grave disappointment to me.
Yeah.
So thinking about this tension was one of the things that inspired me to try to create a whole world around these conflicts.
Excellent segue into my second question, which is, how did you make these people your own? I mean, they're such familiar and beloved writers, and people have very proprietary feelings about them. How did you fictionalize them? And
I did a lot of research before the book, but at a certain point I stopped reading because I wanted them loosed from their historical inspiration. I wanted people to be able to read the novel even if they knew nothing about O'Connor and Lowell and feel caught up in the relationship between these two. And I think, I will be honest, there were some times when I would finish a letter either from Bernard or Francis and write, love, Carlene. And oh my God. But then I also thought, this must be pretty good. It was very personal. It was very alive. So I have to admit, there's some of my own experience I sort of gave to each of them. You know, I wanted to fill in the gaps that the historical record left. You know, did she really have a crush on him? Like, what was the nature of her disappointment? What would she have said to him if she could have said something? And so that's where I think, I hope they start to become people in their own right.
I think one of the great pleasures in reading the book, at least for me, was how well you channel the voices. And people used to flirt differently back
they
then.
Did.
And you have this, like, wonderful sort of His Girl Friday banter.
Thank you, Pearl.
And I wanted to know, like, what kind of research did you have to do? How did you sort of recreate that?
Movies like The Philadelphia Story and those are two of my favorite films.
Oh, mine too.
And I also I've been thinking about this. I also am old enough to have been a teenager while Moonlighting was actually airing in real time on ABC. And I saw that before I saw, Rosalind Russell. Also, I grew up around very verbal women who liked a good joke. And also if you're a certain sort of lady who prizes the written and spoken word, you will necessarily come into contact with young men who feel the same way. And so I think that wanting to honor verbal sparring as a form of flirtation, which, of course, as we all know, goes back to Shakespeare. And I mean, sadly, I should have said it in the modern age to really sort of encourage young women to take it up. Step it up in places other than the interweb. But I think... And I also want to mention there's a great book. There's a woman named Maria Di Battista who's written a book years ago called Fast Talking Dames, and it explores why the women of screwball comedy sort of gave way to the taciturn cowboy symbolized by John Wayne. It's a very interesting theories about gender and history in American society, so I highly recommend that.
I mean, this is a novel that could have been written any number of ways. I mean, I think the first thing that the reader will notice is that, you know, a novel in letters is something that has a very rich tradition. We don't see it that often. But why did you choose to tell this story in this particular way?
It originally started as a third-person omniscient attempt, and I was enjoying myself. But after about 60 pages, I thought, this feels curiously flat, and that's mortifying. And so luckily, I actually had to set it aside to do some other things, so I had some time to think about it. And I've always been a reader of writers' letters. I had read Words in Air, the correspondence between Lowell
and Bishop.
And Bishop had just come out when I was sort of trying to figure out what to do with the book. And there was a letter in particular which people often quoted when they reviewed the book. And there's a letter where Lowell says to Bishop, "You were the one might have been for me." And the next letter Bishop... crickets. And so, I mean, she says many other things, but she does not acknowledge this sentiment, and I thought, that is fascinating. I mean, she was a lesbian. He knew this. And it seemed a version of the Lowell-O'Connor relationship. You have an effusive man and a taciturn woman, and I was interested in playing that out and seeing how that worked, the dramatic potential in effusion and silence created between two letters. And I feel, too, that I think a lot of people feel this way. Collections of letters, you are as engrossed in them often as you are, you know, as with a novel. And so with those few things at hand, I began writing it in letters, and it took off from there. And I'm a person who writes incredibly slowly, so to see it moving quickly was a great relief. It will never happen again, I'm sure. But so that's how that happened.
Okay, thank you so much, Carleen.
Thank you, Parle.
Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Parle.
So what are we reading this week?
Well, on the fiction hardcover list this week, there are three new books. First, I should tell you that Jodi Picoult is not new on the list, but she does finally go to the top of the list with her new book, The Storyteller. Then the three new books on the list. At number 16, a first-time novelist named Edward Kelsey Moore is on the list with a book called The Supremes at Earl's All You Can Eat. A title that I love. And as you might guess from the title, it's a book that's a lot like Fried Green Tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe. It's set in Indiana instead of the Deep South, but it's got this kind of Southern fried feel to it. It's a story of three women, longtime friends going back to high school, who are now middle-aged and dealing with kind of middle-aged tribulations, marriages breaking up and health problems and things like that. Then at number 7, Terry Brooks, longtime fantasy novelist who really broke big with the Elfstones of Shannara series, has a new series out called The Dark Legacy of Shannara. And this is the second book in that series. It's called Bloodfire Quest, and it's new at number 7. C.J. Box has a new mystery novel featuring Joe Pickett, a Wyoming game warden. That book is called Breaking Point, and it's new on the list at number 5.
And he's a bestseller mainstay.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Then on the nonfiction side of things, there are just two new books this week, and they're both quite high on the list. New at number 3, a longtime Florida journalist, a newspaper reporter named Susan Spencer Wendell, has written a book with a co-writer, Brett Witter, about what she did in the year after she learned she had ALS, which is Lou Gehrig's disease. It's a disease with no cure. She knows she's going to die. Her neurological functioning has been steadily declining. This is a book she wrote largely with her thumb on a digital keyboard. It's a book called Until I Say Goodbye. What she did when she learned that she had this terrible disease, she quit her job as a courts reporter at a Palm Beach newspaper, and she traveled the world. She'd always loved traveling. She brought her children with her for part of her trips and just wanted to kind of get as much out of life as she could while she could. And so it's in the tradition of Tuesdays with Maury or Randy Pausch's The Last Lecture. It's one of these books that is kind of facing death with equanimity, and they find a ready audience. And then the new book at number 1 this week is kind of the book of the moment. It's Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In. This book is being presented as sort of a modern version of Betty Friedan's feminine mystique. It is looking at the lack of women in executive leadership positions in corporate America and asking what we might do about that. It's very much a modern version of feminine mystique. To the extent that it's like feminine mystique at all, it has a very modern emphasis on self-help as opposed to looking at
structural things.
Yeah.
I mean, and then like feminine mystique, it's been a touch point for huge debates. Like, is there anything left to say about
Lean In? It has absolutely dominated the conversation in books, in culture, in the business world over the last several weeks at least. Is there anything else to say about it? Well, it's interesting. She really emphasizes an individual standpoint. Her message to women is basically, work harder, girls. Which can sound punishing. It can sound like you're not trying hard enough. It's your fault that there aren't more women in leadership positions. But it's not framed that way. It's really framed as kind of a pep talk. You know, don't be scared and overcome.
Oh, so it's encouraging. Okay. She's not chiding women for...
She's not... But it's interesting to see that it's gotten just a ton of praise from all quarters. But what I look at in the column this week is it's also gotten a lot of flack from across the ideological spectrum. On the right, a woman named Christina Hoff Summers, who I think is at the American Enterprise Institute and who sometimes writes for The Atlantic, just criticized the book in The Atlantic on their website for taking kind of a 1970s feminist perspective, calling for consciousness-raising groups and telling women that they should be more like men, trying to break down the gender stereotypes. And she says, those stereotypes are innate. And, you know, it's a...
Oh, wow. Okay.
I mean, that's the Summers' viewpoint is, you know, women don't want to be leaders. They just want to stay home with the kids. And it's very much a return to kind of 50s gender...
Norms.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Summers is defending those gender norms and saying there's nothing wrong with the way things are.
Being meek.
Exactly. Okay. And then from the left, from a kind of a more of a Betty Friedan perspective, there's a financial blogger in The Guardian named Helene Olin who argues that the problem isn't women. The problem is society, and society is oppressive, and structurally it's not set up to allow women who do want to advance in their careers to do that past a certain point. And a lot of that has to do with caregiving. She acknowledges there is a desire for women to have families and that takes them off of the career track.
And women also do the brunt of the caregiving, well, I'm sure, is part of her.
Which Sandberg acknowledges in the book. And one of her messages in the book is demand equal share from your husbands. You know, women, if you want a family, your husband needs to step up and do more of the work. Exactly. If you're going to balance work and family. I should say, Sandberg is the chief operating officer at Facebook. And she had several high power positions before she ended up at Facebook. And she's upfront that once she had a family, even though she was on this real fast-track career ladder, she would make a point of leaving the office at 5:30 so that she could get home and have dinner with her family and get her kids tucked in. And once everyone was squared away, then she would turn on the computer and get back to work. And as long as her work was done, people let her keep her own schedule. And that's part of the point she's making is it's up to you to take responsibility for getting it all done. Helene Olin says, you know, there is societal discrimination and it's serious and we need to address that before women have the opportunity to advance in their career. Our own reviewer, Anne-Marie Slaughter, in the book review, praised Sandberg for looking at questions of self-doubt among women and for being kind of encouraging and nurturing. But she ultimately took a similar position
and
said, you know, business bears some responsibility for this too.
Yeah. Endless food for thought. Thanks so much, Greg.
Sure. Thanks, Pearl.
Thanks for listening. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our show is produced by John Williams and Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can write to us at books@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.